Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Okay, parents, what does your PTA ask of you? Schoolbook, the education reporting project of WNYC and the New York Times, has been asking parents how much money they're asked for each year from the PTA, and we've gotten hundreds of responses. And not surprisingly, the parents with kids in schools in richer neighborhoods are asked for a lot, and in poorer ones, not so much, if anything. Kyle Spencer has been on this for Schoolbook. She's a freelance education reporter and New York Times contributor. She joins us now to discuss how this plays out. You can read her piece at schoolbook.org, and we will take your calls about whether rules should be enacted to prevent these savage inequalities. Kyle, welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Nice to be with you.
And listeners, we'll throw out the call, the question that you can call in on right away. Is there anything wrong with parents who can afford to giving money to directly enhance the educational resources at their kids' schools, sometimes by the thousands of dollars? Parents, do you give and do you mind? And would you give if all the PTA money was pooled and distributed more equally to schools throughout the system? Call us up, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. So, Kyle, it's certainly not news that, you know, parents in better-off neighborhoods are giving more to their schools and that money is being used to enhance their children's education. What was surprising to you? What didn't you know about the way PTAs fundraise in the city that you've been able to glean through this reporting project?
What was most interesting to me was two things. One was the way that parents feel sort of strong-armed by their PTAs, and some of them sort of willingly strong-armed and others not so much. But that, you know, there are these suggested asks now, 1,300 at the Anderson School. There's many schools in Manhattan that are in wealthier neighborhoods have these $1,000 minimum asks per child. They'll send letters, and then in addition to letters, they'll send reminder emails, postcards. One parent at the Anderson School told me that they even call parents on the telephone and say, like, hey, you haven't written your check yet. And I think what's interesting about this is this move away from, like, hey, we'd love you to contribute to the public school your kid goes to this idea at many of these wealthier schools, hey, we expect this of you, and if you don't do it, you're kind of not really participating here in this community thing we're doing.
Has this gone up in your estimation based on your reporting? Has all this fundraising really picked up since the city schools have had their financing cut by almost 14% over the past 5 years?
Yes. What has happened is that, these PTA presidents will tell you this, that they really kicked in their fundraising efforts about 5 years ago when the first round of cuts came down. And then they just kept coming. So you've had, you know, some schools have lost over $1 million in their principal's budgets, because of the cuts. And the PTAs have just gotten more and more aggressive. And we've seen this all over the country, these kind of professionalized PTAs. But now almost with this, like, really intense purpose and raising, lots and lots of money. And the other thing I wanted to say, Brian, that I thought was kind of interesting is, you know, a lot of people will say, you know, people who support this kind of PTA raising money will say, who sort of want to say, well, it's not really creating inequality. They'll say, well, it's just not that much money. It's not that big a deal in the grand scheme of things. And what I was shocked at was to look at what a principal's budget is. So in New York City, like in an elementary school, principal budgets might be 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, depending on the size of the school, if there's middle school there too. Now, if you have a budget of $4 or $5 million and your PTA raises $1 million, that's a big chunk of your of the school's money now, right?
Yeah. And
that's not an insignificant amount of money.
And here's the contrast, because we've been talking about how much the wealthier schools raise. At schools in poorer areas, according to your article, some PTAs don't ask parents for money at all.
Right. I mean, you've got 78% or so of kids in the public school system who are taking free and reduced lunch, which means they're poor, right? Mm. So a lot of PTA presidents are just not going to go to a family that's homeless or struggling themselves and say, hey, you know, we need you to cut us a check.
It makes sense. And they couldn't be able to cut them very much of a check in any case. By the way, what kinds of disparities does this create? What can PTAs pay for? Because they can't pay for the core teacher salaries, for example, right? So where's this money go?
The thing is, they can't pay for the core teacher salaries, but they do. The core teacher, they will pay for science teachers. One of the schools that we reported on, PS199, paid $100,000 for the salary of a science and technology teacher. Yes, they can do that. I mean, they can kind of do just about anything. And what was another thing that was interesting about this reporting process was that the bottom line is that they can do just about anything except pay for pay the salary of the kindergarten teacher. You know, they can't pay for these core teachers. But what they do, and I think this is really important to understand in this whole process, is they work very, very closely with their principals. So the principals say, okay, guys, these are all the things we want in the school. You know, we want chess, we want yoga, we want this, we want that. You are going to PTA. You pay for all the extra. We want assistant teachers. We want art teachers. You pay for all that in some fashion, and I will take care of the core teachers. So you have principals' budgets that are 95, 96, 97% even higher just paying for teachers, and the PTA pays for everything else. So it's fungible.
Now, before we go to our calls, and our lines are full, and people have a lot of opinions about this, whether there should be some kind of structural readjustment, obviously it's a difficult question because, you know, people don't want to be restricted from spending money in support of their own child's education. A lot of people would consider that a right, or to have some of that money siphoned off to go to some school in some other neighborhood where they don't live. But Chancellor Walcott is well aware of the disparity issue, and yet you're right that he doesn't want to punish parents who give. But he's got something called the Fund for Public Schools and the Fair Funding Formula. So what would those do?
Well, the Fair Funding Formula was started under the Bloomberg administration. It was a way to basically funnel more money to schools that needed it, to give poorer kids that were having issues reaching their literacy in math and English, give them a boost. It's not actually a ton of money. I think we noted that it hasn't been completely funded as it was supposed to be because of budget cuts. But even so, when it first started, a child who was like needier might receive, $200 and change more than a child who wasn't needy. So, I mean, when you compare that to the Anderson School raising $1,600 per child, it's a great idea, but how much difference it's really making is questionable.
An argument that parents push back with in the wealthier neighborhoods, which says Title I funding from the federal government is specifically for public schools in low-income areas to make up for all kinds of disparities, so that when you take that into account, Title I picks up the slack in poorer areas. Have you crunched those numbers?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Title I money, just to kind of like point out immediately, is that it's very restrictive. I mean, that's one of the, I think this is a really complicated issue, and I want to say that I don't think that, I think that for parents to want to spend a lot of money on their kids' education is not something, it's not a crime, and I think it's an instinct that's really wonderful. But this argument about Title I is really kind of a false argument, because Title I money, first of all, goes just to academic-related things, and it's also meant for kids who are, like, really needy. These children are not as needy as the children in general at these wealthier schools. So this is a sense of like, well, it's a level playing field. Those kids get Title I money, so we should. It's okay that we raise PTA money. So, well, no, it wasn't a level playing field. Those kids are getting Title I money because they're so disadvantaged. They're facing poverty. Parents are struggling to help them in school. Sometimes they're facing the fact that they don't speak English. So that's the problem with that argument, I would say.
So, listeners, should parents be restricted from donating to PTAs above a certain level so that all kids in the New York City public schools have some kind of equal shot at a good education? Or should there be some kind of luxury tax in effect where beyond a certain amount, some of it goes into being redistributed to other schools and other neighborhoods? What do you think? Our lines are full, but our website is open, 212-433-WNYC, our phone number, or go to WNYC.org. click on Brian Lehrer's show to post your comment. Matt in Hell's Kitchen. Hi, thanks for calling. What do you think?
Hi, Brian. My daughter's starting kindergarten next year, and we've been doing a lot of research, touring a lot of schools, and we've been absolutely shocked at the disparity. And it is due to the PTAs, and it's not just hiring art teachers and computer classes. It's class size is affected by the how much the PTA is giving, and there are some schools that the class sizes are really low because the PTA is giving so much money. So they are using that money to hire core teachers. So it's been really, really shocking to us. And I think maybe the thing to do is to have a fund where a percentage of what the PTA gives goes to a general fund that is then redistributed equally.
Would you do it as you get ready to support your daughter's education? And maybe the school that she goes to is going to be one of those that asks for $1,000 a year. But you're also told that, well, $150 of that is going to go into a fairness fund, and it's going to go to the South Bronx, or it's going to go to somewhere else.
To me, it wouldn't discourage me. I'm gonna give because I want my daughter to have the best education she could have. But I also, I feel strongly that it needs to be more fair.
Thank you very much for your call, Annalisa in Darien, Connecticut. You're on WNYC. Hello, Annalisa.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. You have a system that deals with this up there?
We do. In Darien, we have 5 elementary schools, 1 middle school, 1 high school. And, you know, people like to think when they're coming into town that maybe one elementary school is better than the other, what have you, or whether there are differences in the PTAs. And while there might be some, you know, ability to raise more funds in one of the school districts than the other, you know, neighborhoods, we have a council of Darien school parents which oversees the 5 elementary schools, and they have a cap that you can spend per student per year that applies to all 5 schools. So it doesn't even really matter how much money you take in. You can only plan in your budget for $100 per student.
How much disparity is there between those 5 schools in Darien?
Well, there's not much. We don't have any schools like sort of to the point of your show, I think, today, that where one school is lacking the funds to spend $100 per student. But we do want to cap, you know, from having a parent walk in. It's a very affluent town, having one parent walk in and give laptops to every kindergartner in one school.
Thank you very much. So, Kyle, do you think something like that could ever be workable in New York City? Or would the powers that be just be too afraid that it would drive even more middle-class parents out of the public schools altogether, and then it would really be a system just for the poor?
Yeah, I think that this kind of sharing of resources or some sort of more regulating is something that parents who are sending their kids to these wealthier schools absolutely do not want and would fight vigorously against. And I think lawmakers know that, and actually I've talked to lawmakers who have said to me off the record, I'm not touching that with a 10-foot pole. So, I mean, the other thing is, you know, like, what Walcott said was, like, really interesting, and I think points to the fact that, like, the system really benefits from having, I mean, the wealthier families and upper-middle-class families and well-educated families in the system. You know, the Times has done a great job recently of reporting on how segregated schools are. So, like, how much the system as a whole is benefiting when all these wealthy families are, for the most part, segregated off on their own is an important point to discuss. But, like, we do want these families in the system, and Walcott certainly does not want to discourage them, and I think that he's made that clear.
Well, why? Why would he care? I mean, many people in the wealthier neighborhoods are deciding between private schools and public schools, so when they're asked to give just $1,000 or even a couple of thousand a year to their public school, they see it as a great bargain compared to private schools that cost tens of thousands of dollars a year. But what would be lost if those parents decided, okay, if I can't spend $5,000, you know, or more or less, on my child's PTA to enhance their education, maybe I will suck it up and pay for private school? What would be lost to the other public students if they actually did that?
I mean, I think
that sort of cuts to the core of what the issue is here. There should be, like, a lot lost because there should be this way in which there's a common, you know, that all schools are getting the same amount, and that when you advocate for PS6, you're also advocating for a school in the South Bronx, right? But that's not really happening. So, I mean, because what happens is PS6 parents are in a system in which they're really able to advocate for PS6 parents through money and through the way the system is so divided by school, and then nothing happens, you know, nothing, you know, they get all these fabulous programs.
That's such an
happens.
Important point, that politically, parents at one school get divided from parents at the other schools, rather than public school parents as a block fighting for the common interests of their children.
And it's what, you know, it's really interesting. I've spoke to some PTA presidents who are now moving, who have been PTA presidents in the past, and they've moved on. They were so busy when they were doing the work of advocating for their public school that they didn't have a lot of time to stop and think. And some of them have stepped back now that they're no longer in those positions and saying, hey, wait, what was I doing?
Right.
And looking over the span of the last 5 years, one could argue that when a wealthy school advocates, gets so much money for its own school that it no longer has to go to Albany or the federal government and say, hey, this policy of underfunding schools is terrible, you've got to stop it, that they almost make the problem worse. I hope I'm making myself clear, but they can make the problem worse for those schools that don't have parents who have kind of political power. It's like, it's kind of like, well, we have this problem. Our school doesn't have enough money. We'll take care of it in our corner. Too bad for you, you know?
Or a more innocent tunnel vision in which parents in the wealthier neighborhoods just aren't aware of what the limitations are in other places, and so they think that parents everywhere are donating to make up for the other budget shortfalls.
Yeah, and Brian, I mean, like, and this is something that just needs to be made so clear. I mean, when you're a PTA president or you're advocating for your kid's school, I mean, that's a great thing to be doing. I mean, it's, like, really hard to – this is not a criticism of people who are advocating for their own school. It's just sort of us looking at it and saying, well, what are the ramifications of this in the long haul?
Ray in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ray.
Hey, good morning. This is actually my wife's idea, and it goes along with what some of the other callers have said. She was saying that she's a public school teacher, by the way, and we have three kids in public school. If a wealthy school brings in more than, say, $500,000, that then they partner up with a school that's not so wealthy, and 10% of it goes to that other school. In fact, it would be great if the PTAs would step up and do this on their own. And maybe I'll make this a challenge for all those PTAs to step up and partner with a less wealthy school. And if they bring in more than $500,000, they give 5 or 10% of it to that school.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great idea, and I wonder if a voluntary system, which is, I think, what he's recommending, might generate less resentment and more participation than if the DOE tried to impose it. I don't know if they'd be willing to go there. But Elizabeth in Brooklyn is a PTA president calling in. Elizabeth, thank you so much.
Sure. Hello.
Hello. So?
Well, I just wanted to say that, I've been PTA president for 2 years. I'm just about to finish my run. And that's been the major revelation of this experience, is how inequitable the system is. And my feeling is, the bottom line is that if you live in a wealthy neighborhood, most likely your public school is fine. And if you live in a poor neighborhood, most likely your public school is not fine or is desperately short of funds. And so the system itself is inequitable. And we raise money for our school, and we try our best. We're actually a Title I school. We also do a lot of fundraising. We don't ask for a specific number. We just ask people to give whatever they can. And I tell you, we get donations all the way from $5 to $1,000,
mm-hmm.
and we welcome it all. Some people can't give any money. We ask them if they can volunteer, if they can help out in any way they can. We absolutely accept all kinds of volunteer and donations, you know, whatever people can give. But I will say, it's just very dispiriting.
What do you think the solution is?
You know, on the one hand, I think it would be better to pool all our money. On the other hand, I don't really trust, to be perfectly honest, I don't really trust the DOE to administer this fairly. They're the ones who have sort of created this system. You know, how does it work? How is it possible that none of these schools have enough money? How is it possible that your school needs $1 million extra just to mm-hmm. provide adequate education? That seems crazy to me.
Maybe an independent network of PTA presidents could administer it instead of the DOE.
Well, actually, you know what I think? I mean, I have a friend who's French, and she says in Paris, there's private schools, but everybody sends their kid to public school. I actually think that the private school system in New York City and the success of it and the high level of it sort of undermines public education to some degree. If all those private school families were in public school, it'd be a different thing. Everybody would be invested in public education in a way that is not the case now.
Elizabeth, thank you very much. Kyle Spencer, freelance education reporter, New York Times contributor, including to our current article on the WNYC New York Times education website called schoolbook.org. Go and see her article about this issue. I want to throw in one other thing unrelated before you go, because it came to our attention, as you know, over the weekend, that the United Federation of Teachers sent an alert to all their members encouraging them to assemble en masse at a rally on June 17th to protest the NYPD's stop and frisk policy. So from your understanding of the UFT, what do you make of them deciding to throw their weight in terms of asking teachers, you can only ask so many times, to gather en masse, right? Usually it's for education issues and their own interest, to gather for something that's not explicitly an education or a teachers union issue.
Well, first I want to say that one of the really interesting things that I discovered about the UFT last year when I was doing some reporting on it is there is a faction of the UFT, they're sort of like the Bolsheviks or something, who have this kind of sense that the UFT should have a larger mission of not just sort of advocating for teachers, but sort of advocating for public policy and for the working man and and woman and that sort of thing.
It's so the traditional founding idea of unions' place in society.
Yes, exactly, that their job is really more, they advocate for their own people, but they also advocate for sort of like, mankind and womankind. So this sort of reminds me of some of the talks that I had with some of those UFT members who at the time were really kind of complaining. They felt like the UFT didn't do enough of that. But I also say that this is, partially, I think, and something to really advocate for students and for some of the poorer, most disadvantaged students in the system. I mean, we all know that this stop and frisk, and one of the reasons this has become such a hot button issue, is because we see minorities, young black men and young Latino men being stopped at a much higher rate than, say, white kid. And being stopped for a little bit of marijuana, maybe if you're carrying around a little bit of marijuana and you're 17, this is probably not a great thing that you're doing, but it doesn't necessarily make you a bad kid. But it can certainly turn you into a bad kid if you end up getting charges leveled against you.
And I guess less generously to the UFT, and we're really out of time, but maybe in their ongoing battles with the city for contract provisions and preserving their pensions and all of that stuff, they want to have this large majority of black and Latino parents whose kids are in the classes that their teachers teach on their side and thinking that the teachers' union is on their side when they need political support in their contract negotiations.
Yeah.
That too.
I think that's a good point.
All right. Kyle Spencer, education reporter, contributor to the New York Times, and to our joint education website with the Times, schoolbook.org. See her article and comment on it at schoolbook.org on these savage inequalities in private funding of public schools. Thank you so much for talking about this with us.
Thanks, Brian.
And coming up next, do plants have feelings too? Botanist Daniel Chamovitz on how plants experience the world through senses and share DNA with humans.